Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com. Welcome to the Summer of Food, a special program on HeritageRadioNetwork.org giving voice to our nation's emerging network of student leaders. From New York to California, students are heading out of the classroom and onto the front lines of the food world, using their summer break to engage in a radical rethinking of our country's food landscape. These are the students that will become tomorrow's food leaders. These are their stories. This is the Summer of Food.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to this episode of Summer of Food. I am particularly excited today to have in the studio with me Shizwe Rochadachi. She's a junior at Yale University majoring in environmental studies with a concentration in food and agriculture. And this summer, audio recorder in hand, she's been working as a farm and ranch hand at the James Ranch in Durango, Colorado. And I'm really excited because Shizwe was one of the first contributors that I wrangled in to the Summer of Food series. And by the end of the summer, she's going to have completed six original pieces for the Summer of Food series that have transported listeners to cowboy country and explored the theory and practice of sustainable ranching. Shizwe, thanks so much for being here.
Great to be here.
I know. It's so great. We were saying earlier, it's really great to meet in person because we've had all this email correspondence and we've talked on the phone, I think, once or twice. And I've been listening to these beautiful pieces. And so it's nice to see the physical person who's
longer a mirage.
Exactly. This magical person creating these beautiful pieces. So first, I'd like you to kind of give listeners just a little bit of background. You know, what are you doing at Yale? What does it mean to be studying environmental studies with an emphasis in food and agriculture? And then how did you get interested in food and ag?
The big question.
The big question. Yeah, we'll start out.
Well, at Yale, studying food and agriculture is definitely a road less traveled, that's for sure. And a lot of my support has come more so from the Yale Sustainable Food Project more than anything, which is the umbrella organization that is responsible for the urban farm at Yale. And they're a really amazing, amazing organization that have been mentors and supporters. And what's great about that is they give you a lot of guidance in terms of how do you study food at Yale, because we don't have a food major. Agriculture is definitely not Yale's strong suit. We're not an ag school. But what I've been doing is within environmental studies, you can declare your concentration, and there's been more and more students who are concentrating in food, which is super exciting. I think I was talking to the director of undergraduate studies for environmental studies, and she said it had gone from like 40% of declared majors to somewhere around 70%. So there's a huge demand now, and this year, for the first time ever, they're having an undergraduate course that's titled agriculture. So I'm super jazzed about that. But the way in which I kind of came about to going to the ranch was I was actually in a class called field science, and we had to write a final scientific literature review. So reading a bunch of papers, creating this essay that talked about something in the field that was happening related to, I don't know, something scientific. It was very broad. And I, of course, try to incorporate food and agriculture into absolutely every single thing that I do, even if it's totally irrelevant to the course. And I had gone on this cattle drive back last August. I was visiting a good friend of mine out at Deep Springs College in Bishop, California, which is a small liberal arts college has a ranch component. And basically, I got thrown up on a horse and said, oh, we're just going to do this short little move in the desert. And granted, I've never ridden a horse, like, really. I think I got walked around one of those, like, kiddie corrals.
Paddocks, yeah.
Exactly, where, like, my horse only moved because, like, the woman was yanking at the reins, not because I was doing anything. And so the fact that I lived was amazing. I think I only did it because I didn't know how dangerous it actually was. But this short move turned out to be, like, a five-hour cattle drive. And it was in the middle of the desert, and I got off that horse, and I felt so good. And I just knew that I had hit upon something that I would have to come back to. And so I did, in the form of academia. And so I wrote about rangeland management in the West using cattle, so livestock, to regenerate those ecosystems, to be a positive force as opposed to a negative force, a degrading force. Because livestock grazing, especially on public lands, is oftentimes, they attribute it to the desertification of those landscapes. And more, there's evidence that holistic management could be the key to creating a positive symbiotic relationship between cattle and public lands. And that was fascinating to me because these huge swaths of land that we're not going to turn into farms, but we want them to be productive in some way. How amazing would it be if we can raise our cattle on them, get beef from them, and at the same time encourage a diverse and stable ecosystem? And so that was kind of how I got into holistic management. How I ended up on a ranch was my one of my coworkers, Justin, at the Yale Sustainable Food Project. I was like, Justin, I don't know what I want to do for the summer. I have to do something. I'm antsy to go do something in the field. I worked on, you know, vegetable farms a lot. And he said, well, take something that's like you never thought you would ever do and challenge yourself and push yourself. And I was like, well, there's this ranching thing. Like, it would be kind of cool to get on a horse and be with some cows. I've never done that, but I doubt anyone would take me. And he was like, just try. So he hooked me up with a couple contacts and some suggestions of what to follow. And a few steps later, I was contacting the James Ranch saying, please, 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 please take me. I know this is, you don't normally have an intern with your beef operation that I can tell, but I will work really, really hard and I will follow you around with an audio recorder in hand and be the best student you've ever had.
Right.
So they responded well to that, thank goodness. And I got a fellowship to help pay for it from Yale, which was amazing. And then, you know, a week after I finished my classes, I was there in Durango, ready with my cowboy boots.
So, you know, you mentioned it was like pick something that you would never normally do. So, like, what were your perceptions kind of going into this, like, fears, you know? And then how did it actually, I mean, we're talking theory and practice here, as you're looking at the academic side of sustainable ranching and going into the field and putting those two side by side and saying what works, what doesn't work. Personally, there was probably that same experience. So
exactly.
What was it like, oh my God, this is not at all like I expected, or this is exactly how it was?
Well, one of the big homework questions for me was I wanted to find a ranch where the fact that I was a woman and not a white woman, a woman of color, I would be allowed on a horse and actually given responsibilities as opposed to just kind of been like, oh, that's cute. You know, like you want to come work at a ranch or not even respond to my emails. I think I was very aware of the male, white dominated Western ranch culture. And I also wanted to be in a farm where it wouldn't be like so painful to get through the summer in that respect. And I was totally shocked when I got to the James Ranch because one, I'm like part Asian and I have dark coloring and I went into this ranch and I look exactly like the family. Like everyone thought I was some distant cousin that they'd never met before. And I think that did something, you know, because you're instantly just incorporated and they're so warm and welcoming. Jen and Joe, who run the farm at the James Ranch, which I worked part-time there. And then Dave and Kay, who are the, you know, the patriarch and the matriarch of the family tree. They run the beef operation, and both of them were just so sweet to me and so welcoming and really took me seriously from the get-go while also incorporating me into the family. And I think that was what I was most shocked at. I thought it was going to be much more of like this struggle
right.
to like beat my way in. And they were just kind of like, cool, like, welcome. You're one of us.
Right. I mean, so, you know, you had this recorder with you the whole time. And, you know, the very first episode that you sent in, there's like the very beginning is you just like plopping down on the couch and be like, huh. So you're really exerting yourself physically and mentally doing all this, you know, learning and working on a functioning farm and cattle ranch and then producing these amazing radio pieces. What was that like balancing those two things and, you know, working in the field and then coming back and having that chance to sort of, you know, sit in retrospect on what you did?
I mean, time-wise, it was definitely crazy. I would, they would joke that on the weekends before I had a piece due, I would just be in hibernation for the weekend because it would be like, you just wouldn't see me Saturday through Sunday. I'd be in the cabin just like typing away and like listening to my voice over and over again. And at first it was also kind of, I was very apologetic. My radio teacher, because I got into radio through a course at Yale, had always told me never to apologize because that's what makes people awkward. And I had to kind of keep telling myself that because you're holding this like awkward thing. But it actually
on a functioning ranch,
exactly right. On a functioning ranch, and you also don't want it to get in the way of things. But it actually became kind of like a sweet little character. My boss Jen named it Mousy because it has a little fuzzy like gray windscreen on the top of it, and they were totally fine with me kind of chasing them around and recording. As far as over the summer, I actually became really appreciative of the fact that I had this sort of outside influence that kept me really present in the moment and kept asking questions. Because I think the hardest thing about being on a farm or at a ranch is it's really hard work and you are exhausted by the end of the day, and you start to get into routines and patterns, and you stop, you know, coming to the table with bright eyes, bushy-tailed. You stop asking those questions because it's just hard enough to get through the day. And so because I kept thinking like, okay, this has to be a dynamic, interesting piece that brings readers in, and like, what would people be thinking? It kept me really engaged and really eager, and it also made me seek out additional opportunities. So for example, one of my pieces includes audio from a local farmer named Dustin Stein. And that was just me going, oh, like Dustin Stein, like he's a cool farmer. Like my listeners would probably be interested in that. You know, my listeners, this theoretical mob of who knows who, they would totally be interested in that. So I just went and like contacted him and chased him down. And I think I was much more bold. And in terms of digesting what I'd learned, it's amazing. Cause I know a lot of my friends go onto the farm and they have this like really great moleskin and they're like, this is my journal. Like I'm going to write every night, and no one does it.
Right.
You know, by the fourth night, you're just like, you've got to be kidding me. And so I'd be exhausted, but at least I could, at the end of the week, be like, oh, like what did this really mean to me? What did this make me think about? How do I feel about this? And that was challenging, to be that reflective in the moment, but man, it was so valuable, and I'm so glad I did it. And I think for as hard as it was beyond worth it.
Well, it's good to hear, because I mean, you paint such a vivid picture, both through sort of the audio imagery that you collect of just the sounds of the farm and the ranch and the cows in the background, and you also paint this really vivid picture, but the way you speak about the experiences, I mean, you can really see these people, these, you know, weathered cowboys in their tan hats, and, you know, the old butcher who's been around, you know, doing butchering for 75 years, you know. And I want to kind of tuck into the idea of, like, using media, radio, you know, radio journals, the internet. Because I was reading a story earlier today, the West Virginia Department of Agriculture actually live tweeted a calf birth.
Oh my
yesterday.
Goodness.
Pictures,
that's
video,
awesome.
And all. And it makes you think, you know, where are we moving with, you know, such access, you know, via the internet to watch and to connect? And, you know, why do you produce these pieces? Why is it important for you to catch your own oral history as well as collecting, you know, the stories from people along the way?
Well, I think in terms of agricultural media, one of someone that made a really big impression on me was Kurt Ellis, who did King Corn. He came to Yale and did a master's tea where you have kind of like people come in and talk to our masters around in like the common area. And we bring in a couple that are kind of agriculturally related through a Chewing the Fat speaker series at the Yale Sustainable Food Project. And he was one of our speakers. And I was talking to him about, I was talking to him after the fact, and I think we got into a discussion briefly about agriculture, and I think he dropped something, said something along the lines about how, you know, farmers, man, they do listen to a lot of radio. And I didn't really think about that until I was faced with having to produce pieces for this radio class that I got into because I'm obsessed with This American Life and I listen to way too many podcasts. And I was like, you know what I'm really interested in is farming and farmers. I go to farms and I hear the most amazing stories. And storytelling and oral history has been so fascinating to me that I felt like these people deserve a platform, you know, to come forward. And I'm also immersed in the world of academia where you read these horribly dry, awful scientific papers that bore me to death.
They bore everybody to death.
Yeah, exactly. And I just think, you know, there's some really interesting things that are going out there in the field of agriculture. And God, like, if we could present it in a This American Life, you know, radio lab sort of feel, it would be so much more digestible to the general public. And beyond that, it would create a sense of, you know, auditory community for agrarians, and I think that's really necessary, especially young agrarians who know how to access internet radio.
Right, and I kind of want to touch on, like, you know, you mentioned young farmers, and that's been, like, the whole point of Summer of Food is to connect with these student leaders. And you mentioned gender earlier. I feel like there's this really big push right now. A lot of young female farmers are entering agriculture. And, you know, I kind of want to get your perception on the sustainability of female farmers and kind of what that means and how you think that's going to develop over the next few years as we're going to have to, you know, increase, you know, young people's engagement in agriculture.
Yeah, well, I think, I mean, just a small sample size, at the Yale farm, we have majority of our female employees, or majority of our employees are females, and you see so much more interest in that arena. I also go to a lot of farms where they kind of badmouth the previous interns they've had that were guys because they were too lazy. And we had, at one farm I worked at, they dubbed the two men who worked there the Molasses Brothers. And I just think that it's, I don't really have an explanation for it, but I just know that a lot of women are getting into it, and it's really empowering. I think part of it is, like, this has been a realm that has not been open to women to be the head farmers, and I think that's fantastic. I think sometimes there's a independent, headstrong nature to that movement that is not sustainable. I also think a lot of, you see a difference when you're at these young farmer meetings. I go to quite a few of them in conferences. You see the people who have read Michael Pollan's book, gone woofing like twice, and maybe had like a little farm love affair or something. And they're just like, I'm really into the ethos of sustainable farming. I'm just so, you know, and they wear like halter tops in the field and like short shorts. And those are the people that either they're going to have a pretty intense wake up call that like farm life is really, really hard. And it's not an escape. You're not escaping any quote unquote system. You're just participating in a different way. I would argue that it's the opposite of escape. It's being the most present you possibly can be in our world. And so then the people who last are the people who realize this is really hard. This is not just a career. This is a lifestyle. I will never probably make much money. I will always struggle, but I will do it anyway because I can't imagine doing anything else. And I really cross my fingers for those people. But I think in order for them to succeed, we're going to have to start getting really creative about getting land and getting those infrastructures. And maybe that's through facilitating these relationships between older farmers and young farmers who are coming into the field through, you know, Land Link and sources like that. But I don't know. I think
it's a big issue.
Exactly. Yeah. If I had the answer, I'd probably just be like the best person ever.
Well, so. I think you've touched on a lot of those answers, and, you know, I want to take a quick break. But when we come back, I want to talk more about this romance versus reality and, you know, creativity and building these infrastructures. So hang in there. We'll be right back with Shizuei Rochidachi.
The song is called Cali Bites by Ball of Flame, Shoot Fire. And as you know, this is the Summer of Food on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
All right, welcome back. We're here with Shizuei Rochidachi, a junior at Yale in the Sustainable Food Project. We're talking about cattle ranching in Colorado and the romance that is, you know, typically associated with agriculture and the back to the land versus the reality of hard work, hard labor, constantly struggling to become resilient. And I want to know how, you know, the experience this summer and your interest in food and agriculture plays into your larger academic and then, you know, professional goals. Is farming where you're headed, or is there going to still be a connection to food and agriculture in another way?
Farming will always be a part of my life. I'm totally, hopelessly head over heels in love with it. But I think I was talking to one of my fellow interns back at the farm recently, who works in the dairy. She's a milkmaid. And both of us are in this funny position where we've come from, you know, I'm finishing my degree at Yale. I'm going to have, you know, high educational background. And we're restless for building and to help create this tangible community of young farmers and to create these support systems and these networks. And I also think there's a role for me that isn't defined of sort of translator between this dense scientific community and farmers. And that was kind of my first experience at being that translator was being at this ranch. I was coming after having done the scientific literature review and going at the end of, you know, my conclusion, all scientific papers, and with, there's still questions to be asked. And mine were, you know, how practical is holistic management? What about the cultural dynamics? You know, that's a big question to ask, or a big thing to ask of cowboys, to stop being masters of their landscape and start being stewards of their landscape. That's huge. Financially, will this work? All of those sorts of questions about, you know, local politics and what this translates into in reality, those had to be answered. And so then I go to the ranchers and I say, you know, how is this working? How is this changing? And how do we connect these two really dynamic communities, the scientific community and the agricultural community, and let them feed off of each other? I think there's a lot to be said. A lot of innovative ideas are coming out of both, and we need to integrate and create a dialogue between them. And I think I would be really good at facilitating that dialogue. How I get paid to do that, I have no idea. But
I think you'd be excellent at it. And I think that's one of the things that you've done in the Chasing Chasm Sustainability series, is that you blend, you know, this memoir aspect of this personal journal with this really, you know, dedicated voice to understanding what's happening. Like, why does the ranch work this way? And you dive into so many different issues. And some of my favorite is that you talk about water use out west, because that's something that a lot of people don't understand.
That's
is that
huge.
The entire western United States is kind of essentially built on this farce that there's water out there when in fact there's not. And another one, I was just listening to the fifth piece today, and you go and visit Sunnyside Slaughterhouse to see the experience firsthand. You go from, you know, collecting the fats and all the way to the, you know, that last butcher block there. And those are those really big issues of, you know, the ethics of eating meat and like having to know those things and see them firsthand. So, you know, how do you blend those two?
Well, it's hard, and it was funny when I started this series. I knew that my voice coming across was going to change. I needed to find kind of my particular style, and so it's funny now. Like, I imagine listening to my first piece versus my last couple pieces. I don't even know if I want to listen to my first piece, but I think for me it was always about, I want to communicate something worth communicating, but I tune out when someone starts talking to me about, you know, a great topic, a dynamic topic, but it's dry. And I always, things, you know, people can digest things when they're in story form. And I also find that's really important. You know, when you pull away the poetic, lyrical nature of what it means to be on a farm, there is some truth to that romanticism. You know, it is beautiful out there, and it is incredible. And that's just as much of a truth that you need to communicate as, okay, this is the scientific value, this is the value of being on a ranch, this is the hardships that come with it, and this is what we're thinking about. I think both need to be communicated, and I also think that's what people want to hear. You know, they don't want to hear just one or just the other, because that you lose the depth of the experience. And so
we're drawn to characters, we're
exactly.
drawn to narratives, and that's how our human brain works, is it's
exactly.
more interesting if there's a narrative storyline and we've given these characters and personalities to these issues or actual people or animals.
Yeah, exactly. And I was hoping that would keep people listening to it, as opposed to going, oh, just we're talking about ranching and we're talking about the ethics of slaughter, and no, like you're going to hear a cow die. And I think that's something that is intense, but I think that's something that if you're going to eat meat, you probably should hear.
Absolutely, and it is intense. And I mean, in that audio imagery that I was talking about earlier is really intense in that piece. You know, and I kind of got a little goosebumpy when I was listening to it, because it is so intense. But you really pull out that poetry in this, you know, kind of really intense experience of, you know, watching a cow, and they crank up this, like chainsaw essentially to cut this, you know, beast in half. And it's a really poetic piece, and it gives you the perspective to say, like, I really should know about this. And I hope the people that have been listening to it, you know, are engaging in it in the same way.
Yeah, well, I think I was, you know, going back to the idea of what I was surprised at, I was constantly surprised at how normal the whole experience felt. I was talking, I think I make mention to this in one of the pieces, but I was talking to one of my good friends who is also working on a farm out in Nantucket, and she was saying, you know, like, you're doing all these things that are kind of crazy. Like, I was just telling her about the story about how my shirt had gotten torn off my back while I was chasing calves out in cowboy country, and how I was going to the slaughterhouse. And she's like, how are you doing? You know? And I was like, it's funny you ask that, because everything has been really normal feeling. Like, I'm just like, oh, today I'm jumping on this cow, and like, or I'm jumping on this horse, and I'm, you know, herding the cows, and tomorrow I'm just going to, like, see one die, I guess. And I was definitely more anxious about the slaughterhouse, but when I went there and saw it, I found myself, you know, moved, but not, it wasn't traumatic. It wasn't even all that emotional, which is not to say there was not a sense of ritual or respect. I think especially in the field slaughter, that was one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen in my life. It was, you know, overcast, and there was mist in the sky, and there was calm, and it was quiet, and I was like, man, if you know, all cows could be killed this way, like, what a beautiful thing. We've stripped that ritual, that sense of respect, from so much of what we eat, and that was really moving to me. And I think I was out there talking to Tom, you know, the old school butcher, and the other people who were butchering with us, and he was like, yeah, it's a pretty, you know, I've been doing this for so many years, and it's always great, you know, it's a nice way of living. And I was like, yeah, man, like, I can understand that now. Before, I'd be like, oh my gosh, you earn your living killing cows? Like, that's brutal. It's like, no. I mean, if you're killing cows that way, it's a pretty great deal. It's you know, he calls them sweet pea when he's cutting into them. And I think that's indicative of a very different relationship with your food than most of us have.
And that's a particularly moving part of that story is that, in, you know, interaction with Tom and, you know, calling the cattle or the steer sweet pea as he butchers it. And we have yet to upload your last piece, number 6. So I want to kind of let you give us a little teaser, a little preview of what goes on in this final piece.
So final piece, the theme is endings. And the tagline is, you know, bringing the meat to market and the college girl back home. And I think we talk about picking up the meat at the slaughterhouse, packing it out, and going to market, both for the vegetables and for the beef, and what that entails. And I also touch on one part that I thought was really important. We follow Dave and I to a diner, and I talk about the important role that the James Ranch has in the community and how they facilitate that relationship. I think that is something that is so important. Young agrarians, old agrarians, any agricultural enterprise does not succeed until they have buy-in from their community. And I think that's a really hard thing, especially when I'm looking forward to my future. I know that I want to have a piece of land and farm it in some capacity and participate in a community as an agrarian in some form. And you have to facilitate these relationships with your community. That's you need to know that Joe down the street knows how to fix a tractor, because otherwise you're going to be, you know, messing around with it for a week before you get it done. You need to know that you can call on Sam and Jane to come and join the, you know, to herd the cattle with you. That's really important. And also you need to facilitate those relationships so that people are loyal to you and your product. And that's something that you see, you know, everyone in town in Durango knows the James Ranch, and they all know Dave James because he wears his white cowboy hat. And when he delivers meat, that's something that he's very particular about. He always wears his white hat because people know him by that white hat. And that's an incredible skill to be gregarious, to stop and talk to the people you're selling your meat to, and to make them really feel at home with you. And I think that was something that I really wanted to communicate at that end, how they're such a warm family that has been embraced by the community and then, you know, embraced me and taught me a lot in that respect.
So, I mean, I want to kind of touch on, like, bringing that back to the city life and bringing that back to your community, your academic community, your peer group, and how do you continue to cultivate that kind of community and that kind of dialogue when you don't have that small town feel? You know, wearing a white hat is, you know, that's like the original branding. Like, how do you do that in the urban setting? You know, with the hectic, you know, busy modern day life, like
it's definitely more difficult. I think Farmers Market is an amazing place where that community comes out in full force. And I think, as simple as, you know, for me, sometimes I work farmers markets or I just show up and like to hang around, the Yale farm where I work, we sell at our local farmers market. And, you know, people recognize us and we try to talk to other local farmers. And even though we're kind of the black sheep in that we're a campus farm and we're not full-time farmers, we try to incorporate in that way. But you know, it's when you're not in a small town, when you don't have that visibility, it's difficult. And I think, case in point, Yale Farm, a lot of people in New Haven don't know we exist. You know, I was taking an airport shuttle. This guy was driving me and we got into this long conversation and I mentioned that I work at the Yale Farm and he's from New Haven area and he goes, "What? Like the Yale Farm?" And I was like, "Yeah, we're on Edward Street at Prospect." And he's like, "Oh, I didn't know that was a farm." And I was like, "Oh, like you should come on by." And I think one thing we do is we have open pizza every Friday, during the warmer months, and we invite everyone, whether they've volunteered at the farm or whether they're just like coming in from a run, you know, to come and to eat with us and to join us and to see what we're doing. I think opening those doors is and letting people in is really important, because I know a lot of people are interested about getting in contact with that community but feel like, oh, if I'm not a farmer, if I'm not like super, you know, if I don't buy all local organic food, like they will, you know, not accept me. I will not be one of them. And I think that's not true. We, you know, in our case, we're also all broke college kids. We understand that sometimes you have to go to Stop and Shop because you can't afford, can't afford what you're getting at the local co-op. And we'd like you to be part of our, you know, movement, if you want to, you know, air quotes, call it that. Even if you're not 100% like all local organic food all the time, or even if you're not a farmer.
And that's something that I've been asking, you know, everybody that I've talked to for Summer of Food is, you know, what is your advice for young people who may have just stumbled on that rabbit hole of food and its larger connection with these, you know, much bigger issues, is how to get involved. You know, what are those first steps that you go from saying, where does my food come from, to being actively engaged in that quote unquote movement?
Yeah. Well, don't think you have to be a farmer. Don't think you have to make artisan cheese. I think one of the best resources is go on goodfoodjobs.com. I've talked to Taylor, who's one of the founders of Good Food Jobs, a bit, and she's the greatest. And I know a lot of my friends who are interested in incorporating food and agriculture into their life somehow. That's where we go to feel sane, because you go there and you're like, oh, I can be hired as like a consultant about sustainable food systems at this college, or I can, you know, I can make cheese at an artisan cheese shop if I want to do that, and I can farm too. But you learn how, oh, this way of thinking is so entwined in so many different markets and so many different realms. I also think you just have to start being innovative about the way you think about things. You know, you can be an economics major and focus in food. You can be a religious studies major and focus in food. One of my friends is doing that. You can get at it from so many different angles, and you can be an important player in so many different ways. Just because I've kind of taken the more quote unquote traditional route, I've worked at one of those artisanal pickle shops, I loved it, I've worked on farms, doesn't mean that that's the only way you can get yourself involved.
No, and sometimes the most, I think, transformative experiences on either side of that coin is people coming from engineering, physics, literature, media, who engage in these agricultural issues. It's like that moment when somebody walks into the room where you've been poring over data or pouring over research and like, what am I looking for? And they walk in and it's like, oh, it's right there.
Exactly.
And you're like, oh, thanks, person who just got here. But like, you know, engaging in agriculture doesn't mean you have to be an agrarian, and it should be everybody, because at the end of the day, we're all sort of working to put food on the table in whatever realm we're coming from.
Yeah, I remember one good example was there's this like group of students at Yale that are like engineers, and they approached the farm saying, hey, we normally do this thing where we look at prospective projects and then we build something, you know, kind of innovative. And so we were like, okay, like, cool. These are some ideas of things. And they ended up building us this amazing chicken feeder that rats can't enter it and eat from, you know, it has like this lever system. And it was just like, that's awesome. Like, we would have never thought to like cross those lines in that way and create a relationship. And now they're kind of like, yeah, we do it every semester. Like, come to us with farm projects. And we're like, great. You want to build us these really awesome things and facilitate this dialogue between us? Like, we're more than happy to oblige.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we talked about like how food and agriculture is like, you know, it's everywhere and we're all working for food. Do you see food and agriculture as a way for young people to engage in some of these like bigger social, cultural, political, economic issues that sometimes feel a little bit intangible, like we can't actively engage in, you know, these discussions?
I think that I keep referencing Yale Farm because it's shaped so much of how I've thought. And our tagline these days is to create food literate leaders, which I think is a really great ambition to have. I think it's about bringing consciousness of food and agricultural issues to the table, but not making it necessarily the focus. Because if you're just going to sit down at the table and talk about farms, you're not going to be able to engage that many people. But if you sit down at the table and you think about, okay, desertification, let's talk about desertification. People from in the science community can talk about that. People from who are coming at it from a social justice perspective can come at it from that. People who know about the history of the areas can come to the table at that. And then I can come to the table and say, hey, why don't we put some cows there? You know? And I think that's what creates that dialogue, as opposed to having it be this kind of overwhelming, scary, big thing of like, let's fix the food system. Mm-hmm. Let's make everyone care so much about farming, because they won't, you know. My closest friends, I love them to death, and some of them, I was talking to them about the slaughter, and we were going out to dinner, and they're like, you know what, like, maybe, can we not talk about, like, the death of the beef? And I was like, or, you know, the death of the steer, and I was like, okay, you know, I think we should talk about it, right. But that's their way of being in the world, and I'm not going to make, you know, pass judgment on that, and hopefully one day they'll come around to it. But I think to expect everyone to be in that same place is unrealistic, and also is demanding a lot, because once you get sucked into the food and agriculture world, and once you start caring about it a lot, you can't escape.
You can't.
It's a black hole.
It really is. And I don't want to call it a black hole. I want to call it like the rabbit hole, because
that's
like
true.
That's a little bit more imagination and like fanciful. Black hole, I feel like we're sucked in and we're never coming back. Whereas food and agriculture, you dive in and it's like you ask that first question and it's just, I want more answers. And the more answers you get, the more questions you get. And it's just like ever-evolving circle of hunting and searching for these answers and asking important questions. And I want to ask you one more question, as you know, we sort of run out of time here, that I've asked a lot of people this summer while talking about Summer of Food, because the word sustainable and sustainability comes up all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of those words that, you know, has been co-opted by, you know, media and branding, and also sort of has become this ambiguous definition that covers all sorts of things. And so I've been asking student leaders to say, you know, define sustainability for me.
Sustainability. I think sustainability for me means the vision of a positive future. So if that practice, if that method, when we're talking about food and agriculture, the process by which that carrot comes to the table, if that will leave a positive mark on this world, and it's something that we can continue to do, and it will facilitate a diverse, dynamic ecosystem, and it will feed people the most nutritious food possible, it'll be the most nutritious carrot possible, and if it will support a local economy, and it will pay for the farmer's kid to go to college, that's sustainable to me. That's asking a lot. And I think when we throw around sustainable, we definitely aren't referring to things that live up to that definition that I like to hold. But I hope that that's kind of at the heart of it. I hope that we've strayed, you know, sustainable has become the new green catchphrase, and it's you know, we use it for branding and it whitewashing things, and I think, or greenwashing rather, things. And I hope, though, that in the back of people's mind, they think, like, sustainable means it will continue to sustain this world, not just the plants and the animals, but us humans, too. And it will do it in probably a very innovative way.
Right. And I had another student, Sarah Franklin, who is at Unity College, and she's a homesteader. And she said, you know, I like the word resiliency better. And I really had to agree with her, because it acknowledges the fickleness of the world around us and the unknown unknowns. And I think this is the second time that I've quoted Donald Rumsfeld on this show, and it really makes me angry at myself. But the unknown unknowns is really true, because in acknowledging that those exist and saying to be resilient, that we can power through these things, that we can be innovative, that we can be creative, is really where this movement, if there is a movement, is going.
And yeah,
that's
and
what makes me excited.
I think sustainability, sometimes people think of it as being a static word, like we've decided that this is a sustainable practice. And I think resiliency suggests perhaps what I believe to be more true, that we will have to continue to innovate in order to succeed.
I think you're right. And I think we're totally out of time, but I could sit here and talk for hours with you. Shuzei Rotojachi, Chasing Cows and Sustainability. If you haven't listened to the pieces, take some time out of your day. Take some time on the subway. Take some time before you go to bed when you wake up in the morning.
Take some time before you finish weeding.
Absolutely. Any of those above. And listen to the pieces. They're incredibly beautiful. They're incredibly moving. And they're incredibly educational. Shuzei, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks so much for having
me. Like all of our shows, this is archived on the internet, on iTunes and Stitcher. And remember, we're a member-supported radio station, so go on and donate. Thank you so much for listening. This has been another Summer of Food with Eddie Schumard.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website, or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.